From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we talk with St. Louis-based journalist Sarah Kendzior. Her book of essays, The View from Flyover Country, predicted the rise of Donald Trump as early as 2012. She says the increased authoritarian policies in this country are not unprecedented.
We've had a lot of the same phenomena that fascist states have had. We just not have had them universally applied. And so I think that that does show it can happen here. It has happened here.
Then, as the anniversary of the Sikh temple shooting approaches, Pardeep Kalika reflects on the life of his father, who was killed in the mass shooting.
As much as we were trying to put a brave face on for the world, it was very emotional to the point that it was hard to reflect on some of these good and bad memories.
And Bubbler Talk answers a question that all fair-weather baseball fans have. How do the Brewers decide whether to open the roof at Miller Park? Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Sarah Kendzior is the kind of journalist people love to hate. She is relentless in her pursuit of the truth. She does not mince words, and she's unafraid of powerful people. She is not in this business to make friends, and she's had the death threats to prove it.
Kendzior is also something of a soothsayer. Her essays written for the Al Jazeera English Language Channel in 2012 and 2013 predicted the rise of Donald Trump and the outcome of the 2016 election before anyone else in the media was taking the campaign seriously. Those essays have been collected into a book called The View from Flyover Country. The book, which takes no prisoners, is now a New York Times bestseller, but it was originally self-published because no traditional publisher wanted it.
Kendzior was in Milwaukee earlier this summer for an appearance at Boswell Book Company. I was invited to interview her in front of a packed audience there, and we started with why the Midwest is such an important bellwether for the entire country.
You know, the kind of conditions that I describe in the book of a lack of opportunity, of economic misery, of corruption, those are conditions that you see nationwide. But I do think that since the recession in 2008, the Midwest has suffered disproportionately. You've seen, an unequal recovery. You've seen cities like New York or San Francisco or Washington, D.C., become these very powerful, very wealthy, and very expensive hubs of media, of politics, of entertainment, of all these industries, whereas industries in the Midwest, I think, have really bottomed out. You see this in creative fields. Our newspapers are gutted. A lot of our cultural institutions were gutted. Businesses departed. And then some of this is an extension of things that already existed in the 70s and 80s with manufacturing shutting down. But I mean, I think if something does connect the Midwest as a region, because, one thing I want to emphasize is that, we are a diverse region. We are not the simplistic caricature that tends to be kind of bandied about by East Coast media. But the thing that does bind us is, one, we're looked down upon. We're called things like flyover country. We're assumed to, not have intellectual attributes or reasons to visit. And also, I think this sense of futurelessness, of sort of being left behind or being cut off from opportunities because it's become pay to play, and we just don't have the money. And so you get this weird paradox where it's affordable, to live in a place like Milwaukee or a place like St. Louis. Not for everybody. I mean, that's something I need to emphasize, that poverty here, I think, is worse than you see in a lot of these wealthier cities. So they struggle with poverty as well. But for sort of a, average person, it's easier to kind of get by. But it's harder to find a job. It's harder to pursue, whatever ambitions you have. Your opportunities are more narrow. And I think that that's happening, not just in the Midwest, it's happening in the South, it's happening in parts of the Northeast. It's really an American phenomenon of the 21st century, but it's, now it's producing worse effects politically, which I'm sure we'll get into. But I think that the refusal to really deal with the repercussions of the recession and this false recovery, this underemployment, lack of benefits, constant instability, I think has come back to haunt us big
time. Wage stagnation is another one, or wage reduction.
Right.
And that's something that we have certainly felt here. People who work for the university, people who work for the school systems, have seen their wages flatten out or go down, or they've lost their jobs.
Right, while cost of living soars. And it soars for things you can't opt out of, like your healthcare costs, childcare costs, childbirth costs, all these sorts of things that used to be, you know, kind of part of the package of life, like people didn't kind of freak out over them in the 50s or 60s or 70s, are now luxuries. And when you turn everyday necessities into luxuries and, you know, don't increase wages or any kind of economic ladder upward, you know, you're in for a real crisis.
These essays that are collected in this book were written between 4 and 6 years ago, mm-hmm. and I know you self-published them because people were interested in reading them all in one place. The thing that struck me in reading the book was that nothing's changed. If anything, yeah. It's gotten worse.
Oh, it's definitely gotten worse. And it's sad for me to read this book, and now it's in greater circulation, and people are reading a lot of things for the first time that I wrote in 2012, 2013. They're like, oh God, someone's finally talking about this. And I'm like, man, you know, and it's not true. I mean, there are other people talking about it. There have been actually positive changes, I think, since I first wrote these, you know, in the labor movement, Fight for 15 and organizations like that are pushing for a higher wage. But overall, the structural conditions, they've gotten worse. The strength of our institutions, much worse. And that's been tested continually since Trump got into office, because you're seeing every institution get tested, not these sort of norms, but actual laws and, you know, people behaving with a kind of impunity in terms of committing outright crime that we've never really seen before. So now we're kind of at a new level of, downfall, unfortunately.
You talk about, you use Uzbekistan as an example for, you know, the idea that following the law is somehow illegal.
Yes. I mean, it's a weird thing. I get asked a lot now, you know, about resistance to Trump and how people counter. I mean, I guess I should give as a background, I'm a journalist, lives in St. Louis. Lately, I've been covering Trump, U.S. politics. This book is primarily about U.S. politics, some foreign affairs. I also have a PhD from studying, it's in anthropology, but I studied authoritarian states of the former Soviet Union, in particular, Uzbekistan. And, you know, as I studied that, I didn't really think, well, this will be really helpful when I cover the campaign of future president of the United States, Donald Trump, and his burgeoning autocracy. That really wasn't what I thought I was going to use my PhD for. But, you know, for all those who say there's nothing you can do with your PhD, I've found the solution. But I studied dissidents. I studied how dissidents from Uzbekistan, but often living outside of Uzbekistan, because if you're a dissident in Uzbekistan, that's what happens, is you end up in exile, were trying to use the internet to bring the government down. And dissidents has been outlawed there for so long. You know, it's very different than America, where you can have protests. We have a level of freedom of speech that's unimaginable there. So they kind of tended to frame their dissent in a way that it was subversive because it was emphasizing the rule of law. All they wanted was for their own officials to follow the rule of law. And so they'd set up these websites where ordinary Uzbeks could ask, like, what do I do if an officer is asking me for a bribe? What if I do if I find out that an official is, you know, stealing money from taxpayers and using it? And I keep thinking, my God, we're in this position now. And it's frustrating to me because, you know, we do have a free press. We do have free speech. It's not perfect. It never has been. But, you know, I'm able to sit here and talk to you right now, and I'm not afraid somebody's going to, like, pull up and come get me, and then I'll, you know, that'll be it for me. We can talk about this, but I feel like there's a reluctance in the press often to confront the severity of these issues head on. There's a reluctance to give people information about kleptocracy, about the level of corruption that we're experiencing, and some of that has to do with the relationship between big media companies and, you know, these corporations and these political systems of power. But, I guess this is a long-winded answer, and the end of it is to say, speak up while you can, and treasure that right, you know, because not everybody has it. And if you have it, I think a lot really can be done.
Well, that's hopeful, because, you know, reading the book, I have to say, it made me very sad.
Oh, yeah, it's like a miserable book. Go buy it.
It took me much longer to read than it probably should have, because I kept having to put it down, going, oh, okay, all right, I need a cup of tea now. I need to go pat the cat.
Yeah, don't read this thing all at once, man. Yeah, you're going to, like, want to slit your throat. But, you know, I think ultimately, you know, kind of like my point at the end, is like, if we don't talk about these problems, if we're not, like, brutally honest about what we're facing, if we don't emphasize the conditions conditions of the most marginalized, the most vulnerable, the people who are suffering the most, there's no way we can fix them. And you know, what is the point of all this? It's to try to make things better. It's to try to help people out. And so unfortunately, part of that process is identifying really severe, often systemic problems and, you know, pulling them up at the roots.
Where do you think this began? Because this didn't begin in 2016. This didn't begin in 1990, I don't think.
No.
Where do you think that idea that somehow the foundations of civilization, as we think of them, as helping each other, as, you know, being better than the sum of our parts, when did that schism happen, do you think?
I mean, I think people, I mean, God, if you want to like go all the way back in time, people have always been selfish. People have always struggled with that side of their nature, and there have always been efforts, you know, for societies to try to keep those conditions in check. And, you know, I'm an anthropologist, or I was, I guess, you know, that's what I studied in academia. So, you know, this plays out differently all over the world. In the U.S., you know, to just narrow the scope of this question a little bit, you know, I think the original sin is race. And I think most of our inequalities can be traced back to that, to slavery, to Native American genocide, to the treatment of Black Americans, and to that being legal. You know, after Trump was elected, we heard a lot of, oh, it can't happen here. There's no way we can have an autocracy. There's no way we can have an authoritarian system. And it's true that we do have a long-standing democratic system. You know, we have a constitution. We have things in place, you know, rights to freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, that usually ensure some sense of a democracy. But we've had authoritarian policies. You know, we've had Jim Crow laws. We've had internment camps. We've had a lot of the same phenomena that fascist states have had. We just not have had them universally applied. And so I think that that does show it can happen here. It has happened here, and we're vulnerable. And so what we need now, I think, is to confront, you know, those systemic flaws, you know, these atrocities, to be blunt, as well as look at, you know, other countries and how they've transitioned out of democracies into autocracies, because you're seeing this happen worldwide. We're not unique in that respect. You see Poland, Hungary, Turkey, all these countries kind of going down a dark road.
Although the Dutch voted in a good way. I mean, they went the other way.
Oh, yeah.
Which was really quite wonderful to see. And you look at the example of Germany, mm-hmm. which came from an incredibly awful situation and have reinvented themselves, but they confronted who they had been,
right,
and what they had done.
Right, and that's essential. And it's funny, because I was in both countries last year. I had this like sort of, you know, horrible world tour where I kept getting invited places because people were like, oh God, is this gonna happen to us? Like, let's bring her here to tell us. And I was always like, you know, yeah, unfortunately it can, and I don't think getting it, you know, asked back. But when I went to the Netherlands, it was right around that time when Geert Wilders, you know, was running, was possibly gonna win. Like, that movement is still there. You know, and I think they're more aware of it. They saw what happened to us. They saw Brexit, which was also unexpected, and they're like, it could happen here. But I think your point about Germany is absolutely right. I spoke with German college students who had grown up being taught to recognize signs of fascism, how to read propaganda. They were taught like a level of critical media literacy that I think the U.S. kind of lacks, and which of course has been complicated by the internet. That's true for every country, and I think a lot of things we genuinely couldn't have predicted. But they knew it could happen. And they knew the risks and the dangers, and so they were much, much more aware. And I don't want to say they're cynical, they're practical-minded when it came to these sorts of problems.
Do you think that something like that could be brought here, and what do you think it would take?
I think it needs to be. I mean, one challenge of anything for America is that day-to-day life is hard. You know, people are working sometimes multiple jobs. People are thinking about, you know, everyday things. How do I pay my bills? How do I take care of my kids? You know, do I have health insurance? And, you know, I work as a journalist full time, and I read like a zillion news stories every day. And I try to make sense of, for example, the Trump Russia case. And I struggle to make sense of all of this and to keep all this in my head. And every now and then, you know, something pops up, some weird memory of a story, like, you know, Peter Smith, the GOP operative who died mysteriously last year with a note next to him that said, I didn't kill myself, I swear. Like, you know, the kind of story that normally would last for like a year. We get like four or five of those every single day. And so it's basically impossible to keep all this stuff in your head. And I'm thinking, if this is literally my job and I get paid for this and I'm struggling, how the hell are normal people who work a 9-to-5 and come home and maybe like watch a little bit of TV news, kind of scan the internet, how are they making sense of this? I don't know. Because that's the thing, is these sort of literacy skills take time. And so what I'm often recommending is for people to, you know, just read more and read history. Because I think if you read history, both the US and abroad, you see these patterns. You know, autocracy often plays out in a familiar way. You know, they call it a dictator's playbook for a reason. And I think that if Americans kind of knew the signs of a kleptocracy, of an autocracy, and then just kind of looked at like basic stuff Trump is doing, like not divesting his businesses and being incredibly secret about it, then they're like, oh, we live in one of those kind of countries. We live in a country kind of like Azerbaijan or kind of like Uzbekistan. Not as bad, not quite as severe, but with the same motivations in the government. And then I think people start to think differently and more realistically about what's at stake.
Sarah Kendzior speaking with us at a book event earlier this summer at Boswell Book Company. We'll have the second part of the conversation with her when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Let's get back to Bonnie's interview with journalist and author Sarah Kendzior, recorded at Boswell Book Company earlier this summer.
Kendzior began this part of our interview by reflecting on her role as a Cassandra in modern clothing.
It's a weird thing. I'm always told that people aren't listening to me, and then I get these like big crowds. And I'm like, but you know, and it's interesting to me because it kind of makes me think they're just like, you know, no one's listening to Sarah Kendzior. And I'm thinking, like, well, who's listening to me? Like, people who live in the Midwest, people don't have a lot of money, people who aren't white, a lot of women. Basically, all of the people who Trump targets are listening to me pretty hard, you know, because I think they realize, yes, this could happen here. Yes, our democracy is at stake. And so I do, you know, have this. It's just kind of like rich white dudes and corporations and in the media. They are listening to me because they're annoyed. They just don't want to acknowledge what I say until it's kind of too late. Like then the terrible thing that they said I was being an alarmist about or being hysterical about, these very gendered terms, then it happens. And then they're like, oh crap, she was right. And I'm also like, oh crap, I was right, because who the hell wants this stuff to happen? Like I'd rather be wrong and be an alarmist and be hysterical and have a better, healthier nation. But yeah, you know, it is frustrating because so much of this is in the public domain. Like, I feel like when I die, like, that's going to be my tombstone. It was in the public domain. You know, Trump was an open book. You know, he committed open acts of corruption for 40 years. He went bankrupt multiple times. He had all these sex scandals. I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg. The Kremlin connections were in the public domain. I spent all of 2016 saying, I think this guy is an asset. And they're like, why? And I'm like, because of what your newspaper wrote in 1988. Which lays the whole thing out, because of what he wrote in The Art of the Deal. I mean, he confesses to his crimes. He gets off on confessing to his crimes. He doesn't want to be punished for them, but he likes to be caught, because being caught lying, being caught committing crimes is an act of power. It says, I am above the law, and I'm going to live above the law whether you like it or not. And so, you know, I kind of saw that coming. And, you know, in terms of the themes of this book, the structural problems we faced were in plain sight. You know, when you'd hear about record low unemployment, and then you look around and you see crumbly buildings, empty lots, gutted malls, people working multiple jobs and living in homeless shelters, you kind of know that whatever these figures are, maybe technically unemployment is low because they're counting working at McDonald's 10 hours a week as being employed. You know, life has become harder. Like the struggle for people has become worse, and it's all in front of you. And I feel like there's been this collective gaslighting for, you know, I mean, probably more than 15 years. I mean, I'm sure, you know, we were talking before about Watergate, which was its own kind of gaslighting, or Iran-Contra, or these other sorts of things. But, you know, it beats down your consciousness. It makes you think, like, am I right? Am I going crazy? All this kind of stuff. And I think, you know, trust your gut and trust what you see in front of your eyes. And if somebody is announcing to the world, like, hey, I obstructed justice, they did. I mean, this is the world we're in, where the nightmare is reality. And, you know, the only way to kind of wake up for it is to confront that it's ongoing.
I think one of the other things that's frustrating that I hear from listeners and just in general conversation is that the structures that are supposed to be in place to check all of this are not doing their jobs, whether Congress isn't doing what it's supposed to do, whether the courts aren't doing what they're supposed to do, whether people aren't voting. I mean, because that's another thing, too. People feel completely disenfranchised. How do we break through that when the very structures that we've put up to protect us aren't doing that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on in that question.
I think,
first, you know, in terms of checks and balances, that's both in and out of our hands. You know, I think we have the power to pressure officials, to document what officials are doing, to encourage the officials who are trying to look out for our best interests despite, you know, the objections of the Trump administration. But in terms of voting, in terms of citizen action, I mean, I've seen more engagement, more commitment, more willingness to turn out, you know, incredible sacrifices of time and effort on behalf of ordinary citizens to try to turn this thing around. And it's not just about Trump. It's about issues like gun control. It's about women's rights. It's about science. It's about the environment. You know, we see massive protests about these things. We see huge engagement, and we've seen big turnout. You know, we have a Democratic senator from Alabama now. And so that's the whole element of this that's unpredictable. Like, the autocratic practices of the government are actually pretty easy to predict, especially with someone like Trump, who's been a public figure for 40 years, has left behind thousands of interviews, has told you his plans, you can kind of assume he's going to follow them. That's true for a lot of people in the administration. These are some old guys. I mean, they're, you know, sorry, that sounded rude. That's not what I meant. You know, these are men, they're almost all men, in their 70s, who have a long track record. And so you're able to predict where they're going to go. You can't predict public behavior. You can't predict how citizens will act. And I've been very pleasantly surprised by how citizens have acted. I feel like the people are fighting back. And so that's good. And that, we'll see what happens in the midterms, because there are other challenges. There's voter suppression. There's the fact that I worry the GOP may just simply not accept the votes of a Democratic sweep or even just a Democratic win, because the unthinkable has become the possible these days. But I do have some hope when I look at what citizens are doing.
Well, and I can't let the media off the hook, and you certainly take the media to task in the book, and I think rightfully so. Maybe a good way to frame this is, what media are you talking about? Are you talking about all of it? I like to think the outfit that I work for tries really hard to tell the truth,
right,
and to find the truth and tell the truth. We don't always succeed. We don't always do as good a job, but I like to think that we have ethics and that we have standards that we're trying to adhere to, and we're trying to tell people what's going on. I don't think every media outlet feels the same way.
No, they don't. And it's a mixed bag. And, you know, I'm in the media, too. You know, we're part of it.
Yeah.
And I don't think that there's, you know, outlets with the possible, well, with the exception of Fox News, Breitbart, and some of the more obvious, you know, Trump propaganda outlets, I don't know what else to call them, that are just one thing or the other. You know, most places are a mix of writers, and I think it's more useful to look at the individual journalist, look at their track record, look at the quality of their work, does it hold up over time, and kind of judge that way rather than dismissing anything wholesale. And also, you know, allow people to change and to learn from their mistakes. Like, I wish more people learned from their mistakes in 2016, but I'm glad that at least some of them did. But yeah, you know, one thing to talk about with the media is just the financial state of it, you know, which I get in this book. At around 2000, 2001, there began a crisis, which at first had to do with the internet taking profits from print media and a kind of, you know, reorganization of how the whole thing operated. After the recession, the media was gutted. And what you saw was a conglomeration of journalists in the most expensive, most elite cities in the country, you know, in New York, DC, San Francisco, LA, a little bit Chicago. Now, one out of four journalists lives in cities like that, and there are whole areas of the country that aren't covered at all. When you have that, and when you have these sort of unpaid internships and, you know, expensive master's degrees suddenly being required, you get a very elite, privileged group of people telling you the news, who I don't think are completely in touch with the everyday reality of people, and who are also, you know, they look at somebody like Trump maybe as more familiar, or they look at their life, which has been so easy, and think it can't possibly be that bad here. Things can't possibly get worse. I mean, I just heard that over and over, you know, this sort of optimism, which maybe is just an American quality. It's American exceptionalism. But in the media, I don't know. But at the same time, the other thing is that they recognize they had a cash cow in Trump. They recognize he was great for business. He was great for ratings. They said it outright. You know, Les Moonves of CBS said he's terrible for America, but he's great for CBS. Jeff Zucker from CNN had a framed Trump tweet on his wall. He hired Trump's campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, while he was still getting paid by the Trump campaign. That's not an independent media. That's the kind of thing you would see in a country like Russia or like Hungary or places where independent media is getting cracked down on but hasn't been completely eliminated, although Russia at this point it almost has. And that's very worrisome because that hasn't changed. I see people making the same mistakes. I see, you know, basically what I've been calling court stenographers, people who just, you know, Trump lies and they just repeat the lie. And he tweets, you know, he tweets because he doesn't want to have press conferences. He doesn't want to answer questions. He wants a one-sided conversation. And he puts slogans in those tweets over and over, you know, witch hunt, witch hunt, witch hunt. And those slogans are lies. And then the press repeats the lie. It's like this giant echo chamber that often can go unchallenged. And they need to step up, and they need to kind of study how propaganda works and kind of think how are these old tactics, because this is like the same stuff Hitler did, you know, from like the Lügen Press to Leni Riefenstahl's documentaries to the big lie concept of Goebbels. I mean, this is literally the same stuff that he did translated into the digital age, and I just wish people would be more thoughtful about what they're doing when they cover this man.
Do you think journalists in some of those more well-paid, because certainly public radio isn't terribly well-paid, and I'm sure you're not making a fortune with what you're doing. Do you think they're afraid for their jobs? Do you think that they're basically looking over their shoulders going, I can't do that because my family will be destitute?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know they are, because some of them have told me. You know, and I do feel bad for them. I mean, these aren't people who are actively out lying and being propagandists and whatnot. These are people who just feel like they would like to leave. They would like to do something else, you know, and do more honest work, work with more integrity, more independence, and they feel like they can't. And that's the thing, is journalists are in a financial squeeze, and they're often in a position where they have a, you know, kind of a demand on the amount of material that they need to produce that's just enormous. It's just like, you know, write 8 articles a day for clicks. You know, there's a lack of investigative reporting. There's a lack of overseas reporting. You know, those are things that we've lost big time, you know, in the last 10 to 15 years as we've transitioned into the internet. And there still are reporters doing this kind of work, and they're doing a good job, and it's necessary, but we need more of it. And, you know, I do think for a lot of journalists, it's not necessarily a choice they're making. They're not waking up each day thinking, you know, I'm going to be a Trump propagandist, I'm going to boost him. A lot of it is exhaustion, laziness, desperation, dealing with the lawyers of different corporations. I know this is something I've had to deal with as a freelancer. You know, the editor loves it, and then I know it's going to the lawyers. And there were points where the lawyers would be, you know, perplexed that I said things like Paul Manafort worked for Russian oligarchs, like a fact. I mean, it's like in Paul Manafort's biography. Like, you can get it, you know, like he has admitted it. So I'm kind of like, I think it's all right, everybody. And there's so much anxiety. There's so much fear. And that often is as much of a factor as any kind of, you know, ideological bent.
Well, and that's how dictatorships happen. It's fear is a big part of that.
Yes.
And that's something you talk about a lot here, is that's the thing, that's the cycle that keeps happening.
Right. And it's, you know, a lot of it is financial. And with Trump, you know, his sort of group of people, his group of lawyers / mobsters / fixers have been very adept at bullying and manipulating the media for decades. And so, you know, they've used those exact same tactics. Things like excessive litigation. That's why we don't have Gawker. And granted, you know, I had a lot of problems with Gawker. But, you know, Peter Thiel, on behalf of Trump, shook that place down to the ground. And I think that that's the kind of censorship we're probably going to be seeing more of in the U.S. It's not going to be a decree from on high. It's not going to be like we're repealing the First Amendment and we're going to tell you about that. It's going to be people suing each other, people threatening each other, people bullying each other. And then, you know, you definitely see things like this kind of culture of conformity where everyone's afraid to be, you know, the hysterical person in the room. And I'm like, you know, hey, I'll take that role because, you know, it's necessary. Like, you got to tell the truth. It's often an unpopular thing to do. It's often very unpleasant to do when you're talking about terrible things happening to people, but it's necessary. And, you know, I encourage journalists, when they see something quite blatant and terrible, don't feel afraid to say that it is and that it's upsetting, because it's upsetting for everyone experiencing it, and we're in this together. I think the more we see that, the better off we are.
Sarah Kendzior is a St. Louis-based journalist, scholar, and the author of The View from Flyover Country. The book is a collection of essays she originally wrote for Al Jazeera in 2012 and 2013, and we spoke with her about them at an appearance at Boswell Book Company earlier this summer.
Kendzior has also written for The New York Times, The Guardian, Foreign Policy, and The Globe and Mail, among others. She's also a frequent guest on television news and talk shows. You can find out more about her and about her book at WUWM.com.
This weekend marks the 6th anniversary of the Sikh temple shooting in Oak Creek. We'll look back and look ahead on Lake Effect next on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. August 5th marks the 6-year anniversary of the Sikh temple shooting in Oak Creek. The hate crime left 6 people dead and 4 others wounded, and the killer later committed suicide. Among those who died in the ambush was the temple's leader, Satwant Singh Kalika.
This weekend is a time of reflection for the entire Milwaukee community, but it holds a particular significance for Satwant's son, Pardeep Singh Kalika. The younger Kalika has tried to live up to his father's philosophy, working with Serve to Unite, an organization that teaches tolerance to young people. He also co-authored a book with former white supremacist Arno Michaelis.
But on today's show, Pardeep Kalika talks about his father's life, which began in the rural village of Dogal in the Punjab region of India, where Satwant was a farmer. Difficult times and violence led him to move to America to seek better opportunities with his wife and 2 young sons. Eventually, he came to lead the Sikh temple in Oak Creek.
Pardeep Kalika joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and recalled what life was like for his family when they first moved to Milwaukee.
It was difficult. You know, they worked for not much and quickly realized that there was no way to sustain living just one income. And so my mom had to go back to work. And I remember at that time I was probably about 6 years old, 6 or 7. And my younger brother was 4 or 5 years old. And it was really kind of up to us to watch each other's back. It was just a struggle and a battle to not only just make it in Milwaukee, but, you know, the culture of Milwaukee was also shifting at that time. And there was a lot of jobs that started to leave town. And that left a vacuum for you know, now you're replacing manufacturing legitimate income jobs for, you know, an illegal economy, kind of just a, because you couldn't survive. And I remember growing up trying to find places that were safe. So we moved around quite a bit from neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood. And both my mom and dad were working. My mom was trying to learn English so she could get a job. And we would spend a lot of time at home just kind of watching TV and at the mercy of watching reruns of different shows and really not seeing faces that were similar to ours be anything. So idolizing those that did not look like us, it was difficult because then you're losing a little bit of yourself and your culture. And at that time, I mean, it was kind of common. People called it the melting pot. And it sure was, you know, a melting pot at that time as you lost a lot of yourself. And I just remember early on just really being, it being difficult, making friends in different places and trying to adjust. And I mean, I can look back at it now and say, okay, well, that was a blessing to be able to meet different faces. But at that time, I would oftentimes miss some of the friends that I would leave at the old apartment. And we went from the north side to the northwest side, to the west side, to West Dallas to South Milwaukee, to Oak Creek. And really, like, this whole journey has basically got me to the point that it's like, if we don't start to invest in all the neighborhoods that exist, we can't segregate violence. If we don't start to invest in all areas and start to see ourselves within an entire city, state, nation, no place is safe.
You mentioned you felt as if you were losing part of yourself. You're kind of living in split worlds, you know, still trying to connect and identify with American culture, yet at home you have the strict upbringing as well. One memory in your book relates to your father deciding to cut yours and your brother's hair after being bullied so badly in school for it. How did he come to that decision, and what do you think it showed about him and his sacrifice and commitment to trying to establish this new life for all of you?
Yeah, that's a great question, Audrey. I know that it was a difficult decision for him. He was a very spiritual man, and anybody you talk to in town, he could basically read a passage and memorize a passage and tell you the passage. But he also was empathetic to the suffering of his children. He saw that we were coming home and we were crying and we were, telling people that people are, and what we had at the time were Judas. At that time, the man bun wasn't a popular thing. And this was very much likened to a man bun covered by cloth. So people will go around and really just tap you on the top of the head and liken it to a buzzer in Jeopardy. Then asking you questions like, what is under there? Well, it's my hair. Only girls wear hair like that. And so all of this was just kind of commonplace. So we would go home and he wrote in his journal that was one of the hardest days of his life, was to take us to the barbershop and have our hair cut. And I remember it was my brother's hair that he got cut first. I remember being a little bit envious of why did he get to assimilate faster than I got to assimilate? Now that I look back at it, it kind of makes sense. He was trying to hold on and do it. Like, he couldn't take it all at one time.
It's kind of a testament to something so deeply important to him and his religion, and yet having to make these sacrifices and adjustments for the sake of making it a somewhat more tolerable experience. Yeah. Do you think your parents or father recognized that through this new life, even though you kind of had to play both roles, hide the music you were listening to, or yeah, the friends you were hanging out with, or the girls you were dating who weren't Indian, do you think they saw this as later on just a strength that was added for you and your brother, that you got to have these dynamic experiences, even though it was hard for you growing up to have such a strict household, but yet outside of that household, it's a different American culture?
Yeah, no, it Audrey, it was hell. Growing up, it was literally hell, because you wore different masks. You wore an at-home mask when you were like, okay, well, let me just be kind of traditional, and I'll talk, we'll talk this way and we'll talk that way. And, out in public, it was kind of wearing this other mask of, well, I'm a boy, man, growing up in this culture, and now I got to be hard and I got to be tough and I got to blend in. And, yeah, and dating was just, it was difficult as well, because you couldn't tell your parents that I was dating someone. So I don't think they really thought of it as a strength at that time. They would have been like, you're trying to be too American. These kids don't know our culture. And it was just, you're caught in between different things. And now that I look back at it, I say, okay, you know what? Some of what happened on August 5th was really reminding me to say, okay, you know what? You need to take your own voice back, whatever that voice is and whatever you're meant to be. You need to come back to that and take that voice back, because there's value in your culture being part of this culture.
You could, I suppose, say that your father was that centering force, that constant reminder of this is your culture, this is who you are, where you came from. But how does his demeanor change towards you as, you grew up and your relationship changed, from childhood to teenage years and all the discipline and the hell that you went through to adulthood leading up to his death? How did he know that he cared and loved and respected you?
Oh,
and vice versa, you know?
Yeah, no, so it was really, it was a journey with both my mom and my father. But for that part of, just knowing that somebody loved you. My mom was very much more nurturing than my father was. My father was the type, and I didn't understand this later, but he would kind of show you. I look back at it and it makes complete sense now as a 42-year-old man who has children of my own. But at the time, each time I used to leave home for an extended period of time, like if I went to college, the day of, he would get into a heated argument with me. And I was like, why is this pattern always like, as soon as I'm about to leave, he gets into this really just argumentative state of mind where we're both lashing out at one another. And over time, I realized that was his way of showing me that he was going to miss me. And he had to, like, prepare himself to be able to miss his son. And it's just a weird culture of masculinity that we were trying to navigate. But later on in life, once I had my own children, he would just do things. And these things would be just simply random. I would come home and I would see him picking the weeds out of the flower bed. And now you have the 60-some-year-old man who's doing this. And he's kind of gleaming over at you and saying, okay, I see you haven't done this. So there was this part of, like, you haven't really won this fight. And for sons getting out of the shadow of their fathers, I think that there's always some fight. And he would just every once in a while do things to say, you know, the shadow might not be as bad as you think it is. My final day that I spent with my father was just a beautiful day. And it was August 3rd. It was my birthday, and this is 2 days before August 5th. So the last time that I saw my father, he was giving piggyback rides to our children, and he was just happy being a grandfather. He was always, because of how he grew up, and he didn't have a welcoming sort of culture for him to come into, his vision was to create that and create a community that other Sikhs could come to and worship with and assemble with and share, like, just be welcomed so that they don't have to sacrifice some of the culture that we had to sacrifice. But, you know, he was very content where he was on August 3rd, and I could tell. And then just later on, we drank a little bit more and played with the kids, and there was this genuine, like, I respect the way that you did things, Dad. And I know that you respect the way that I'm doing things. And that would be our final sort of memory together. And it was a great one.
Your father had a favorite saying, work is worship. And you mentioned that farming was sacred work for him as well. And throughout his life, after he established himself here in Milwaukee, was building businesses, building the temple, and you mentioned he had this truck forever. Like, no matter how well he did or anything, like, he constantly rode that truck or was doing repairs himself, things like that. You know, do you think that was kind of a good example of who he was, like, kind of the character that he kept this truck around and just did everything by himself no matter how good things were going?
No, it definitely was. He never bought a new car, and at some point he had gotten to the point where he was financially capable to buy a new car or a house or, you know, what you name it. But he was financially capable of doing that. But he had so much of that humility from when we didn't have money that he would definitely do everything on his own. Whatever he could do, he would do on his own. That truck was actually a gift that I gave to him, it was beautiful. It had an 8-foot bed, which is perfect for, like, drywall, flooring, and all kinds of things, right? And so that truck is still, I mean, it's still in our family now, and it keeps running and keeps running and keeps running. But he was the type that he would work himself to sleep. There was times when he would be jackhammering, and now this man is 170 pounds. He's really wiry and super strong for, like, the size that he was, and he would never give up. He was like that, that wiry sort of fence that, like, you just can't cut. It's like it's like almost a pain in the ass. But he would outwork you. He would outwork you, and there was days when he was. He worked himself so hard that he fell asleep for 3 miles, and you get home and he's collapsed out again, taking ibuprofen. But he wanted to push you.
With the anniversary coming up, I imagine, of course, it's a somber time. But as the years pass on, you know, does your reflection of your father change with every anniversary?
Yeah, it does. Early on, I think. as much as we were trying to put a brave face on for the world because we felt the responsibility to do so, it was very emotional. I mean, emotional to the point that it was hard to reflect on some of these good and bad memories. And, you know, when somebody loses somebody in that capacity, there's this sense of processing that needs to authentically happen. And for us, yes, we put, you know, but we were gritting our teeth through a lot of that. We were still mourning. We were still thinking that the world is unfair. You know, everybody is out to get us, against us. So there's this anxiety with it and all types of feelings that you have wrapped up in, you know, your emotional skin that you're processing through. So over time, it has very much become a journey of authentic healing. And it changes now because now, since his death, my wife at that time was 7 months pregnant. And my youngest two boys had never seen their grandfather. But they speak as if they know him. And they speak as if he's a friend. And I think there's something spiritual within us and within our DNA that lets them know and feel that he's still there. And there's mannerisms that they have that I know that they haven't picked up by seeing him move around, but they just have to be genetically encoded. And there's things that they say that he would have said. And there's this sense of, I guess, in myself, the sense of contentment and gratitude towards life being that way, that we can get to a point where we can really spiritually heal because we know that the person is not dead, but has transitioned.
What would you like listeners to take away about your father and in their own reflections as this anniversary comes up?
Yeah, and I hope that people think about their own loss and their own story. Your story is an honor for someone to hear, and it's going to help somebody, and it really needs to be cherished. Over the past 6 years now, I have been inundated with stories of people suffering and stories of people's pain and you know, almost every type of mass shooting you can think of, from survivors from Columbine to Sandy Hook to children that grieve for their parents. And what I've learned throughout that time was, if you value that people share their story, then you can work through your own pain. If it's a burden for you to hear other people's stories and journeys and suffering, then somehow, some way, vicariously, you pick it up, because we're not honoring pain. And overall, I think this country needs to really accept and honor the pain of the past so that we can really heal going forward.
Pardeep Kalika is the eldest son of Satwant Singh Kalika, the president of the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin, who was murdered in the mass shooting that took place at the temple on August 5th, 2012.
Kalika is also the co-author of Gift of Our Wounds and co-founder of the organization Serve to Unite. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can hear more of their conversation and see photos at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then on Bubbler Talk, we learn how the Brewers decide whether Miller Park's roof is open or closed. That story when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Mitch Tyke with a sports question, or maybe it's a meteorology question, or maybe a little of both. Let's say you had Brewers tickets for a Wednesday matinee a couple of weeks ago. You knew the game was going to happen because, well, Miller Park has a retractable roof. So it is not a question of whether to pack the umbrella, but rather whether to pack the sunscreen. Fortunately, the Brewers have a roof hotline. 902-4636.
You have reached the Miller Park Roof Hotline. It is Wednesday, July 25th. The Brewers will play the Washington Nationals at 1:10 p.m. this afternoon in Miller Park. Weather forecast is calling for sunny skies, temperatures in the 80s. The roof is expected to be open for this afternoon's game.
So that's how we find out whether the roof is open or closed. But listener Lila Johnson wrote in with a related but slightly different question.
Yeah, I was wondering, how do the Brewers decide whether the Miller Park roof is open or closed at game time?
Lila is a recent transplant to Milwaukee from Minnesota, whose Twins don't get to decide whether to close the non-existent roof at Target Field. The Brewers do get to decide, but how do they go about that? We reach the guy who knows, Steve Ethier, the Senior Vice President for Stadium Operations for the Brewers. Steve Ethier, how do the Brewers decide whether to open or close the roof at Miller Park?
Really, it's predicated on fan comfort, first and foremost. And of course, right along with that would be making sure that we are able to play the games as scheduled. That is the whole idea behind the roof. Certainly, if there's snow or rain, we need to close the roof.
Rain or snow, sure, but what about those days in April when we've all been huddled inside for the last 5 months and it's sunny and just a little brisk outside?
You know, it's interesting how we're all conditioned. 52 seems a lot warmer in April than it does in September, for whatever reason. Maybe it's because we just endured an extreme winter, but we typically use 60 degrees as our threshold. So if we look at the hourly forecast and if throughout the time frame of the game, the temperature is not going below 60 degrees, and there's no precipitation in the area, generally we would have the roof open.
These are game time questions he's talking about, but to adapt a local weather maxim, if you don't like the weather, wait half an inning and it'll change. How do the Brewers handle a situation when it's sunny and pleasant for opening pitch, but the weather goes downhill faster than a shaky bullpen?
So we can move the roof one time during the course of the game based on weather. Then if we elect to move it a second time, that's when you need, you know, to consult with the umpiring crew chief and typically both managers.
That list does not include the opinion of the players, who aren't given a say in the matter. That has not always been the case at retractable roof stadiums. Back in 2002, the Arizona Diamondbacks used to close their roof at superstitious pitcher Curt Schilling's request. That wouldn't happen today.
I think it's less these days of players having strong opinions, but certainly in the past they did, and the operable roofs were kind of a new phenomenon, and MLB sort of had to catch up and quickly develop some procedures in order to ensure fair play.
And Ethier says that's really at the heart of the issue about whether to open or close the roof during a game, making sure the opponents are afforded the same weather conditions as the Brewers, except, of course, when the Cubs are in town. Okay, Steve Ethier didn't actually say that. I'm Mitch Tyke for Bubbler Talk.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
And Bubbler Talk wraps up the Friday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce the show, along with Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski and assistant producer Maddie Andre. We get additional support from our fantastic interns, Ben Benversi, Lauren Keene, and Gabby Powell.
Additional reporting comes from Susan Bentz and Taryn Powell. Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor, and Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and be sure to be with us tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air is next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.